everyone. Before we start, I wanted to let you know, if you would like to watch our whole service, head to our website. That's dc2.me. And from the media drop-down, click sermons. You can watch our whole service there. And now, here's this week's sermon.
Today's teaching is based in Matthew chapter 26, and we're going to read verses 26 through 30. While they were eating, Jesus took a loaf of bread, and after blessing it, he broke it, and he gave it to the disciples. And he said, "Take, eat, this is my body." Then he took a cup, and after giving thanks, he gave it to them, saying, "Drink from it, all of you, for this is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. I tell you, I will never again drink of this fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom." And when they had sung the hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives. Today our story is one of a Jewish man leading a group of people. And appropriate that we maybe kick off with the story of a different Jewish man, Alfred Eisenstadt. I don't know if you've heard this name, but Alfred Eisenstadt was born in Poland to a Jewish family in the early 30s, and at 1930s, and at the age of 14 was given his first photography camera, and instantly he knew he was destined to do photography for the rest of his life. At the age of 20, growing up in Poland, it was the 1920s, and he had moved to Berlin at that point in his career. But in 1935, things in Nazi Germany, as a Jewish Polish man, were getting a little bit hot. And so to flee persecution, he came to the United States, and he ended up landing a job with a little tiny outfit called Life Magazine. Here's some of the photos that you might say, I don't know that name, but I know those photos. He had a career that lasted over 40 years at Life Magazine, consisted of over 2,500 photo essays, 90 covers, an incredible career. One day, he got sent on an assignment to Michigan University to go do a story on their marching band, one of the best marching bands in the country, those that particular season. And he was waking up one morning, and he looked out the window of the dorm where he was staying, and he saw the drum major. And the drum major was practicing all by himself in the middle of this courtyard, fully dressed and ready to go. And he got out his camera, and he started taking a couple photos, and it seemed like a really brilliant moment to capture. Because when you're the drum major, you high step. I mean, this is Michigan University marching band. This is a big deal, and I don't know if you've ever watched someone be a big deal all by themselves, but of course you're going to grab a camera and snap some photos. So as he's sitting out there taking photos of this guy, all of a sudden he notices some of the staff kids, like kids from the faculty of Michigan University. There were a couple of them over here playing baseball in the baseball diamond, and a couple girls that were over jumping rope, and all of a sudden one of the outfielders spots the drum major, and he sprints over. And as he runs over, some of the girls see what's going on, and they run over, and then the rest of the baseball kids. And the first kid just got behind the drum major and just started marching. And then every other kid got behind that kid, and they just started marching. And Alfred, being a man of the moment and understanding that photography is about people, of all the photos he got of the marching band over that story, one of the most famous photos he ever took, something that American presidents would later call the happiest photo ever taken, he snaps this photo in the courtyard at Michigan University. Sheer joy. This is an important week for those of us that love the story that God's been writing. Today is Palm Sunday, for those of us that love to celebrate Palm Sunday. I find Palm Sunday just a conflicting, how are you supposed to feel on this day? This is a day that marks Jesus in his triumphal entry into Jerusalem as people are waving palm branches and saying, "Hosanna, praise God, it's here, the story's happening." But as people in this stage in the story, as we look back, it's weird because we know that in 5 days, everybody shouting Hosanna will then be shouting Crucify. How are we supposed to feel today? There's a lot of different processions and parades that happen over a week like this week. On Thursday night, Jesus will gather with some of his friends for a special meal. On Friday night, a night that we call Good Friday, we celebrate the death of God. And then next Sunday, we'll be back for one heck of a party as we celebrate something that is nearly impossible and wonderful. This is a week of parades, and I think if there's any image I can put in your head as we go through our story today, we're going to recall this image a bunch of times. God leading, and the invitation to just run up and walk behind and to imperfectly emulate and delight and follow. Our reading today comes from this particular week about 2,000 years ago. Jesus has already entered Jerusalem. There's some really funny stories that have happened. On Sunday morning, he told a couple of his students, hey, go into town. There's somebody else's donkey's tied up outside their house. Just grab it, and I'm going to use it. And they're like, what do we say if they're, like, bothered by this? He said, just tell them that I need it. And they're like, okay. And they grab this dude's donkey. And they're like, yeah, Jesus needs it. And he's just okay with it. So awesome. This Thursday that we're going to, Jesus is coming into Jerusalem, and there's a particular house, and we don't get a lot of details, but he just knocks on the door of this house, and he's like, hey, we're going to have a Passover meal at your house tonight. And apparently the guy's just like, okay, great. And they, like, these weird things have been happening all week. So we light into our story at this place where his students have been sent to this house to tell them, like, hey, we need to use your house for this big meal. And we'll click in, we're going to read verses 19 and 20 in Matthew 26, and then verses 26 through 30 one more time. And it says this, so the disciples did just as Jesus directed them, and then they prepared the Passover meal. And when it was evening, he took his place with the 12. Verse 26, while they were eating, Jesus took a loaf of bread, and after blessing it, he broke it. He gave it to the disciples and said, take and eat, this is my body. Then he took a cup, and after giving thanks, he gave it to them, saying, drink from it, all of you, for this is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. I tell you, I will never again drink of this fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom. And when they had sung the hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives. This Passover meal idea, it's kind of a big idea. I would love to invite you. I think there's like 50 or 60 spots left maybe for this coming Friday. We transform this room, big long banquet tables, and we'll celebrate a Passover Seder meal together. You're invited. And as soon as we run out of space, we just can't hold anymore. So if you haven't signed up and you'd like to sign up, what's happening in just these few short verses is absolutely mind-blowing. Because Jesus in this moment in a meal is tying together thousands of years of Jewish history into a moment and then just turning it and saying something brand new is going on with this meal. But this meal is strange. If you've ever been a part of Jewish culture, even this particular Jewish meal, this is a family meal. Like, there's a whole program that goes with this thing. There's four cups of wine at everybody's dinner plate, which for some of us is terrifying, and for others you're like, where do I sign up for this again? We won't have wine this Friday. I'm so sorry, and you're welcome. Four cups of wine, and each one of these cups means something so important and deep and wonderful. And there's different points throughout the meal, and you'll get to see on Friday night where kids actually have some lines that they read, and it has to be kids who read those lines. And other lines that have to be read by the mother of the house, and it has to be read by the this is a family meal. And this time of year, especially 2,000 years ago, if you're Jewish, it's best to celebrate this meal in Jerusalem. So your family, extended family, would come from all over the place and you'd have them in your house. The fact they just went knocking on somebody's door and said, hey, we need the biggest room in your house for 12 people for a Passover meal. They were using it for sure for their own family. And they just said, sure, yeah, you can use the space. But that's not the weird thing. The weird thing is when they get to that part in the story where, like, okay, it's time for the kid to read the line. I mean, I'm sure everybody, like, chuckled and like, gave the lines to John. He's, like, the youngest of the students. He's like, hey, you have to do that part. He's like, dang it, always. Who did the mom's part? I don't know. I would love to think that there are some ladies in the room that just don't get mentioned because of how they wrote stories back then. But I don't know. But hiding right there in the story is this idea that, like, Everybody should have been with their family. Like, Peter's family was gathered somewhere, and noticeably absent is Peter. And Matthew's family is somewhere, but he's with Jesus. And they're having this family meal, and I think if there's anything wild to point out, I mean, there's so many things here, but I want to draw our eyes to the point that Jesus is saying, hey, we're going to have a family meal together. Why? Because the way that I see you is family. We're going to do this together. There is an us to this thing. It's a big deal that this rabbi, as he's going through this traditional ceremony, is taking moments to say, hey, this cup of wine, this matters. This part of the meal and these things we're going to eat, this matters. He's not denying the story that's happened so far. Also, he picks up what will become the third cup of wine. And he says, this is my blood. This is like somebody messing with like a nativity scene and saying, hey, this wise man, we're going to shift him out and we're going to put in a doll from one of the members of the band Kiss. Like, what are you doing? You're not supposed to mess with that. Jesus is totally shifting something that's been here for a long time. And while it's a little bit of a different picture maybe than the drum major, the same sentiment exists. Jesus is saying, this is my blood. Death is coming for every single one of us. We're wrapping up right now in the church calendar a season called Lent that begins on Ash Wednesday by marking your head with ash and reminding ourselves, I am going to die. At this meal, as Jesus is picking up this cup, he's just acknowledging, we are going to die. I am going to die. This is my blood because I am going to die. And I can totally imagine, like, his students, the disciples, they're just like, whatever. This is the guy who, like, just told us to go find and steal somebody's random donkey. And, like, we just knock on this out. Like, I don't know what he's doing. But if that's what he says, that's what he says. Like, just John, just drink the wine. Like, just pass it on, dude. Nobody really understands, I think, in this moment exactly what's happening except for Jesus, who is high-stepping it towards death. And all his disciples know is like, I don't know, I'm just following him. Whatever he does, like, I'm just going to try and do that. But they don't know. This whole Passover story harkens back to an older story. This whole meal came about not because someone was like, hey, here's a wild idea, how to throw a party once a year. But it was to commemorate something that was deep in the tradition of the Jewish people. Back in the book of Exodus, we won't go there, but I'll sum up the story. Because of circumstances made by their own choosing, the nation of Israel, the Jewish people, had become enslaved in the land of Egypt. And they cried out, and God heard them. And he called this man Moses, and he said, Moses, I want you to go talk to Pharaoh. And the initial request was this, just ask him for a few days to bring the people out into the desert so y'all can worship me. Pharaoh said, absolutely not. Moses came back a few times, and Pharaoh just continued to say, no, you may not go. And then the request changed. Let my people go entirely. We are liberating these slaves. I've never been like someone else's slave here. I do know what it's like to feel stuck. And I do know what it's like to feel like there are things in my life that I cannot get out from underneath. And for all the ways, and I think it's good and right that we can look at this story and go, man, sin, darkness, brokenness, every single one of us understands what it's like to be a slave. There is a whole other level, and something that for me is like, I can't touch that, I don't know. That comes with the racial implications, that comes with the work implications, the systemic and generational issues that come with slavery. To understand the guttural cries of this group of people, really hard for me to get anywhere close to understanding, but I can understand a bit. Moses keeps coming back, and finally God just says, okay, we've got to pry Pharaoh's hands out of these people. And so these plagues come, and the last of the plagues is this wild moment. God says, here's what we're going to do, an angel of death. Death is coming. You're going to die. This angel of death is coming. Here's what I want you to do. Kill a lamb. It has to be a firstborn lamb without blemish. And you're going to take its blood and you're going to smear it over the doorpost of your house. And then when night comes, your family, you're going to have to get ready to go fast. Pack your bags quickly. In fact, the bread that you make, you don't have time to put yeast in it and let it rise. You've just got to cook it straight before it's yeasted, like these are crackers. You're going to eat this very quick meal. And then when the time comes, you're going to walk out the doors of your houses and you're going to be free. So this night comes, and to everyone, Egyptian or Israeli, that had blood over their doors, their kids are saved. It's their firstborn sons that were going to be killed. Their kids were okay. And if they didn't, their firstborn son died. And these families, as they're making their way out and grabbing these crackers and having this quick meal, make their way out. And here's just some scenes from this story. This is what it might look like to have blood across a doorway, but they come together. The first thing they have to decide is, well, now where do we go? Do we just scatter to the seven winds, or do we stick together? And it just seems like God is so keen to keep them together. It's not a run for safety. It's a stick together. There's a future together. There is family together. Whatever happens, it happens to us. And God seems to be throwing his name in the hat with them too. This isn't a you and a me. There is an us that starts to happen as these slaves are set free. They're led out into the desert. They're following God. God, the way he manifests in this story, is by day it's this pillar of smoke. And by night it's this pillar of fire. And wherever he goes, they go and they go together. They come to the sea, whether it's the Red Sea, the Sea of Reeds, lots of different ways to interpret what's going on here, but he makes a way through when it just seems like death is the only outcome possible. You're going to die, but I'm high-stepping it through. Get in line. Follow him perfectly, but here we go. And the story of these people, this was their moment as a culture of liberation and being set free. And so every single year, this wasn't their idea, it was God's idea to say, hey, let's have a meal every year. Let's cook our bread super fast, no yeast, and we're going to remember every single part of what it meant, the story of you being liberated. It's the Passover Seder. Each one of these cups, it means something really deep. And the point of that story is, through the blood, we can follow God together. This is fundamentally the story of the Bible. This is what God's been speaking over us since he made us. This life of following Jesus is not just about a confession of faith, of saying some words and then just kind of waiting around. It's not even about your own individual experience of Jesus and the journey. But it just sticks out like a sore thumb to me. Jesus, in this upper room, is grabbing his disciples and saying, we're going to do a family meal together. You know why? Because we're family. And we're going to celebrate a time when God was gathering his people together and saying, it's not just me and you, it's us, because we're a family. We were meant to do this together. These last few weeks, today's the last week in this series of celebrating 25 years at Discovery Church. And it has been such a gift to me. I hope it has been to you too. But some of these stories I didn't know. Some of these stories I knew, but just hadn't internalized how important they were. And there were a lot of stories that didn't make the editing cuts. Some that were really funny. Some that were really hard and sad. And I think after 25 years, we have confessions to make as a church, because we haven't always done this thing perfectly. It's hilarious to hear stories of master plans that we've had from years past. Are we about following our master plans, or are we about following our master? I think we have two things to confess. We haven't always nailed it. We have had dreams and plans and even funds that were dedicated to particular projects that haven't been able to happen. And whether it was changes in our needs, changes in the needs of the community, or emergencies, or pandemics, Things have adjusted time and again to fit the needs of the moment. And while these changes in course have seen some good and some hard times, they have not been perfect. And a second confession. Our hearts have been consistent that through the life of Jesus, the heart of this church has been to follow God together. As we confess these things, I just want to thank our land use planning team and Tom Morris and Becky Eads and our past and current elders who have led the way, and for everyone who for the past 25 years has given their blood and sweat and tears and faith to not only the ground of Discovery Church, but to the family. You haven't done it perfectly, but you're behind the guy that's high-stepping. We say that we're all about welcome, and in a time where loneliness is the pandemic of our culture, I think we have two things to confess. We haven't always nailed it. We have a long way to go in the realm of welcoming and hospitality and invitation, mentoring and discipleship. And when it comes to our engagement with people in the margins of our community, we have a confession to make. There are places where we have also participated in people feeling unwelcome. We still have so much to learn and so much room for compassion and care where the church has been the center of so much pain. And for those who do come, not only to feel connected to this community in a meaningful way, but to feel connected to God in a meaningful way, we still have room to grow. And our second confession, our hearts have been consistent. That through the life of Jesus, we are seeking to follow God together. And I'd like to thank those that serve on our racial justice team, and to everyone who leads, whether it's a life group, or in the Nest, or in our special needs work in the Avenue, or our men's ministry, or our kids, or in students, or countless more. Thank you for the ways that you show up. You know that welcome and invitation and discipleship matters. One thing I love about this church is how we engage with our local and global communities, and I think we have two confessions to make. While I'd suggest that we have done some exemplary work, work that long predates my time coming here, it's so good, we still haven't always nailed it. God still has a lot for us to do when it comes to how we're working and loving in our community, and how much more we have to give and to share, and how much more we have to learn and to love and to lead. Unique to our community, our adults with special needs are requiring so many more resources than they have. And while there's strides being made, there's more. We have a population of seniors that are about to overwhelm our system, and they will need to be cared for in a meaningful way. Mental health, no matter the age, continues to be a place where the healing touch of both the church and mental health professionals is desperately needed, and we can help with both. How are we loving single parents and teenagers, the incarcerated, the widows and the unhoused, those struggling in this very difficult thing that we call marriage? Now, can we do all of these things and work equally and finish the work with all these people? Absolutely not. But we do have more to do. And I, for one, am excited to see how we will get to do it. And I'm excited because we also confess that our hearts have been consistent, and that through the life of Jesus, we are seeking to follow God together. I just want to give a huge thank you to our benevolence team, to our local partners and our global partners, and to the building of the barn for being a place where so much good to the community flows out of. The beauty of our story as a church, the beauty of the story of what Jesus is doing in that upper room, the beauty of this Passover story is how consistent it is. The people in these stories, they're not perfect. I mean, they're pretty messed up, and they are continuing to mess up. We will still mess up as a church. But long before my time, and I firmly believe long after, I do think this is a church that has given its best. We've sought God's heart as best we knew how, and we've done it together. Much like that photo of Alfred's, for 25 years it hasn't looked perfect. We're following the one who knows the whole march, who knows the church thing, the whole following God idea. He knows what it's supposed to look like, and we're doing our best to run and keep up. As we look ahead, I grew up in a young life culture that loved this quote saying, "The best young life is yet to come." And while I think the sentiment of that is good, I think it denies the beauty of where we've been. The best is happening, I think, all the time. It's just the best to get to be a part of it. But there is more yet to come. How can a coffee shop become a relational nucleus for a community to grow? How can an affordable housing project speak the gospel not only to those who get to live there, but to anyone who hears the why behind the project? How can volunteering a few hours downstairs hanging out with special needs kiddos totally change the way you understand how to worship upstairs? How can intentionally learning about oppressive systems and structures open the door for our church to better experience the crazy diversity we see in God's kingdom? And why is there more yet to come? Because the life of Christ is still inviting us to follow God together. And God is not yet done taking us home. One question that's plagued the church for decades, and at least for my entire lifetime, if not well before, is this: will you be a part of a local church? Will you commit to being a part of a journey together? I want you to know that you can belong here at Discovery well before you believe. Being a follower of Jesus is not a prerequisite to joining this family, of being a part of this community. But one major question is this: do you want to be a part of it? Or are you just watching it from the outside? To be clear, of course, there's a time to watch it from the outside, at least for a while, but if you've begun to blend watching church with being a part of it, then I want to encourage you to consider, are you watching or are you in it? Church is not a community to be watched. It is a community to be a part of, and you're invited to be a part of this place. Two fun invitations for us today. The first is this. One of the things that's come up in some of these interviews for these videos that we'll watch in just a second is how many folks that I've run into, whether they were in this interview or just people that have been talking about, like, I remember when. They said, I remember pulling up to this lot when there was nothing here and just getting out of my car and walking around and praying. And it has been such a jolt of lightning to my soul to be like, man, we should do that. Like, I'm sure that there's some of you that you do this still to this day. But one of the invitations from today is, what does it mean to be a part of this place? I don't know. What would it look like when you drive by here on a Wednesday morning or a Thursday evening, or when you're here to pick up a kiddo from youth group on a Wednesday night? Just come 5 to 15 minutes early and just get out of your car and walk around and pray. We have this huge affordable housing project that we're still working on and trying to get off the ground. It's going to need a lot of prayer. Pray for that. Pray for this building. But man, more than that, pray for the people. Pray for who is here. Pray for our leadership and for our elders. Pray for the people who are going to be new that week. What would it look like to just come and walk around the land and pray? Would you do it once a month? And when you walk, maybe consider grabbing a friend. If you're here with a family, even with little kids, consider doing it together after church on a Sunday, once a month, and give the gift of prayer away to them. And as you walk, keep that picture of Alfred in mind, that with each step as you walk, you're really just following a Jesus who is already high-stepping around this place. And we're just here trying to catch up, doing it imperfectly, messing up, with sheer delight on our face. The second invitation is this. As we wrap up this series celebrating our first 25 years, we've had weeks where we've considered some symbols that are really important to us as a church family. The first week we talked about our symbol, the logo of this compass. When you see it, do you remember that we're all about Jesus and the journey? That this is a place for people, not just Christians. The skeptic, the doubting, the believer, the longtime follower are all are welcome. Second week, we talked about this idea of the plow, which you passed on your way in. When you see it, do you see a community that pulls together, that needs everyone, that we're simply a group of people that till the soil and then wait on God to make things grow. The third week we talked about the cross hanging behind me. When you see it, does it cause you to remember and wonder how you and we and our church and God is a lantern out into the community and the guiding light of all who are here? Finishing out on our fourth and last week, I'd love to invite us to celebrate through one final symbol. It's the walls. If you've never been in our basement, the second invitation is this. Head down today, and when you get to the bottom, just take a left, and you'll see a framed portion of the concrete foundation. Check it out. But maybe to tell you a little bit more of that story, check this out.
Moving from Chris to Aspen Creek and moving from Aspen Creek to Legacy and moving from Legacy to here, there were major shifts and moments that were like, are we still doing this?
It was just such a faith thing to see God provide a building, provide land, provide a building, provide leadership, provide the staff that we needed, and you know, just when we needed it, at the time we needed it.
It's been one of those things with Discovery. I feel like we've seen several times that you try aim for something, you're like, boy, I don't think we can do that. But that's the point.
And I have filed about what, 5 or 6 master plans in our head. But that's again where you got to come back to go master plan. Who's your master?
And you keep praying, and you keep watching those miracles happen, and they're all around.
But it's also just been the work of God in our own lives, like raising kids here.
We have one of our daughters married in this building. We're gonna have our grandson dedicated in this building. Like, there's a lot of life that's happened, and we've seen, like I said, God in it. Some of it's been really hard. Some of it's been sad. Some of it's been joyous and delightful, and there's been these miracles, but it's been,
yeah, awesome.
It's all of that. It's the journey, the compass, you know. Yeah.
When Pat Gable had her celebration of life, and I was watching, and it just kind of struck me, well, these people are going to be celebrating me. What a gift. Even, you know, all the OGs, we're going to die off, but like, it makes me really comfortable to know that we've participated in something that is way beyond us.
I remember when once the superstructure was kind of up for the building, we had everybody come and write things on the wall in the basement about what the church should be and what it would become.
I just remember enjoying walking around and seeing the variety of families who together had chosen their spot, whether it's on the floor, whether it's on the framed walls, and together deciding what they were going to put in their hearts to bless his church. So powerful.
And Bob and Susan Combs brought a group of guys in from Compton to help us build the acoustic panels and all kinds of
the
stuff.
The playground, yeah.
Yeah, the playground.
Yeah.
And they all signed the walls. And a couple of them came back a year or two later and was so excited to show people where they'd signed. And that was, you know, I don't think you could find more than a square foot that hasn't been written on.
Do you remember what you wrote on the basement walls?
Thank you. Thank you.
Walls can serve a lot of different purposes. Walls can hold up a roof. Walls can be the place you hang pictures or monuments to the past. Walls can be the line between who is in and who is out. But walls can also have the primary function of holding doors and windows, the places through which people are welcomed in or where they are sent out. Long before we had this building, people have been writing on the walls of this church, installing doors and windows with their time, their generosity, their leadership, their vision, and their commitment. And they have been writing it together. After 25 years, we are not done. There are people and places in our community that are still in need of risky faith and of prayer and of time and giving, and above all, an invitation to join a community that, through the life of Jesus, is seeking to follow God together. And they are in need of people who spend their lives on the walls of this church. Do you want to write something? Even if you've written in the past, what new thing may God be calling you to write today? Would you be a part of this place? There's new space on the walls every day for someone new to make their mark. We don't want to be a community that simply holds up a roof, or be a community that loves to marvel at pictures of the past. We especially don't want to be a community that draws lines of who is in and who is out. The walls of this church will continue to be just one more place where people can not only come in to experience the goodness and the beauty and the truth of heaven, but where heaven is also breaking out into the world around. We will be a church where, through the life of Jesus, we continue to follow God wherever He leads, together. There's room. Would you like to join the walls? What will you write?